I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Classical music fans in Central Florida have a choice of orchestras if they want to see a live performance. I will speak with Aaron Collins, Artistic Director of the Space Coast Symphony Orchestra, and Christopher Wilkins, Music Director of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra, about the state of orchestral music in Central Florida and the direction their organizations are heading. Also, May is Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. The Asian population is the fastest growing in the United States, and Orlando is home to a thriving Vietnamese community. To talk about that community, I'll be joined by Thomas Nguyen, former host of Saigon Radio, a Vietnamese radio station broadcast through Central Florida. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Aaron Collins. Aaron is the conductor and artistic director of the Space Coast Symphony Orchestra. Aaron, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us also by phone is Christopher Wilkins. Christopher is the music director of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra. He's also music director of the Boston Landmarks Orchestra and the Akron Symphony. Christopher, thanks also for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking, what is the state of classical music in Florida? And Aaron, let me ask you, do you get the sense that there is a good appetite for classical music here in Central Florida?
I think so. I think we're seeing a kind of a transition period here in Florida. But I do see that all the orchestras, particularly the ones here in Central Florida, are doing quite well. And, of course, changing things to attract new audience members. But I feel like things are going well here in Florida.
So you're 30 years old. That seems quite young for the conductor of an orchestra. Are you in the company of other young conductors, or are you a bit of a pioneer in that regard?
No, I think that's kind of another thing that's happening here, especially in the United States, is a lot of young conductors are emerging, getting these wonderful opportunities to conduct all the great orchestras around the United States, and I'm just kind of riding that wave as well. You see that with a lot of artists as well, musicians who are young, dynamic, attractive, and really kind of bringing new audience members into the halls.
How did you come to be the director and conductor of this orchestra?
It actually was formed 5 years ago, and I had have been conducting around this area for quite a while. And I really wanted to kind of take the traditional mold of an orchestra and flip it upside down, kind of try to do everything just a bit differently. So the orchestra kind of took some initiatives that were very important to kind of separate ourselves from the other orchestras that are doing great things for the community, and try to get new audience members. Some ways we've done that is having all 18 and under are free to any concert, which I think is very important. I see a lot of orchestras starting to adopt something along those lines to really get young people into the concert halls. We also have a program called Symphony for Everyone that allows anybody to come to the concert, no matter what their financial background is. So you see a lot of low-income families coming to concerts that have never had that opportunity before. So these kind of two bold initiatives kind of was the basis of the orchestra, and now it's kind of blossomed. We do about 90 concerts a year, and a lot of great outreach programs and education programs, and it's ballooning into a really great great ensemble and a great thing for our community.
Is classical music the kind of thing which flourishes in a weak economy, especially on the Space Coast? They've gone through some troubled times with the closure of the shuttle program, and the economy took a hit from that. But have you seen that in the following you've had for your orchestra?
Yeah, and our area has been hit quite a bit with the space program, and but I think it's just the way you present it. I think orchestras have to kind of approach things differently. It used to be where we're all in this ivory tower. It's kind of a sense of, I don't want to say elitism because it's not, but it's I think all orchestras are trying to become more accessible, more engaging, getting out in the community, and becoming friends with their patrons. I think the Space Coast Symphony has done is getting out there, knowing our members and our audience, and kind of creating a special relationship. And I think a lot of orchestras are doing that. And with the help of social media, I mean, it's a way that we can have direct access, and our patrons can have direct access with us.
Christopher Wilkins, let me ask you, do you have the sense that it's a good time to be conducting an orchestra? I mean, what are things like in Orlando? Is there a good appetite for classical music in Orlando itself?
There is, and I think there's a growing appetite. It's a very challenging time to be with symphony orchestras across the country, but in that is a lot of opportunity. So I completely agree with Aaron that it's a matter of doing things differently. It's a matter of creating access and inclusion for all segments of the community.
Does the Orlando Symphony Orchestra offer free concerts and those kinds of things to make things attractive for younger audiences, people who don't have so much spare cash?
Yeah, we do. We've offered outdoor free concerts. We've offered our educational programs are all free, and that's quite a large number of programs. And I would guess the same is probably true for the Space Coast, because you say you give 90 concerts a year. Is that what you said, Aaron?
Yes.
Yeah. So probably a lot of those are educational.
Absolutely.
That's a lot
of neighborhood concerts and educational programs.
Yeah. And I imagine a number of those are free.
Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you a question about schools. How important do you think music education, and is it something that more resources need to be put into, and do you have any ideas on how that could be done?
Well, I do think it's important. I think a lot of research, neurological research into the brain or research into early childhood development, it constantly comes back to the arts, and music in particular, for reasons of the development of the cognitive brain, seems to be quite a magical medium. So, and I think things have pulled back a little bit from the severest cuts, but it depends on what community you're talking about. I think what's encouraging is that the national conversation has shifted, and there's a greater emphasis on, the soft sciences, as it's sometimes referred to. But, each school district has its own priorities and battles, and the reality is that modern life has so many more stimuli, so many more avenues for entertainment, so many more different kinds of skills that are required, that orchestras are competing in a much more competitive environment than ever before. So, yeah, all of that shouldn't come as a surprise, and it does mean probably that orchestras need to pick up more of the slack than we used to. And as I said, we can't assume that the schools are going to do their job in that sense. So there may be areas that we need to be doing it that they're not. And the flip side of all of that is that there are more kids who want to be in symphony orchestras, who want to train as orchestral musicians, than ever before. Youth orchestras are exploding across the country. They're more numerous, and they play better than ever before. So I guess like a lot of fields, you could pick almost any field and say, the quality has exploded, and there's a lot of interest at the top. It's just the general population now may or may not be connected with whatever field of endeavor you're interested in.
Well, Aaron, let me ask you that question. Are you seeing an explosion of interest from younger people in classical music?
I am, and I think programming is one central part in attracting young audiences and getting them interested. I know when I was a kid and I saw an orchestra for the first time, I was amazed by the just absolute adrenaline and excitement I got from seeing that orchestra and seeing the passion on the stage. And that kind of just connected to me almost immediately. And I do think it's a job for the orchestras, not only the schools, but the orchestras to get in there and do their best to really engage those young students in school. And they have to be a little more proactive about it these days rather than relying on the schools bringing in kids to the concerts and so forth. I think it's kind of turned the other way around where the orchestras have to actually be proactive about it. And that's a challenge, but a doable challenge.
Christopher Wilkins, let me ask you, with your experience in conducting and directing different orchestras, is there a difference in the audiences, for example, in Boston and in Orlando? Do you find there's a different blend of people attending classical music in these two different cities?
Well, Boston is kind of a unique circumstance because they're free outdoor concerts on the Charles River. So we get a lot of families, we get, picnickers and a lot of kids. Next to the stage, we set up something called the Maestro Zone, where kids can come up and conduct. We put scores out there, and my assistant conductor's there, and he shows them how to conduct, you know, live during the concert, which you could never do that in the Bob Carr Performing Arts Center. It would be such a terrible distraction. Audiences vary from community to community depending on the nature of the community, but in general, I'd say the classical music audience tends to be more affluent, tends to be more white, tends to be a little bit older. Some of that is just part of the nature of the beast. Some of it is, of course, we're trying to change. We'd like to have younger and more diverse at all levels. And certainly huge progress has been made, but we've got a long way to go still.
Well, let me ask you a question, too, about diversity. Are you seeing more interest in conducting and directing from women and from minorities in the classical music scene in the United States these days?
Well, yes. It's slow. I think we all wish it were quicker. The fact that the overwhelming majority of conductors are still men is a bit perplexing, given all of the progress that's been made on the gender front in other fields. Conducting is one of the last frontiers. I mean, there are important and prominent women now active in America, I'm happy to say, but it's still a low percentage, so we have work to do. And in terms of racial diversity, it's really still the same. It takes a generation or two to develop the talent, of course. If you're talking about diversity within the orchestra itself, that's 20, 30 years of training. And there are outstanding programs that have really helped develop minority talent throughout the country that have done just fabulous work. The Sphinx Organization out of Detroit, for example. We have one in Boston called Project Step, which is devoted to minority string players, and there are lots of others. Also, the general trend in music education toward more community-based orchestral playing as opposed to school-based. I'm thinking of the El Sistema program, which I'm sure is familiar to some in your audience, but not everybody. A system that came out of Venezuela and now has swept the world, really, is recognizing that orchestras are a really powerful social tool for kids who get involved with them, and that that can cut across all economic and social barriers. And that, I think, has begun also to greatly diversify the participation of the children who are involved in younger orchestras in those cities or those communities that have an El Sistema program.
I'm speaking with Aaron Collins and Christopher Wilkins about the state of classical music in Florida. Aaron is the conductor and artistic director of the Space Coast Symphony Orchestra. Christopher is the music director of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra, among other orchestras. You can join the conversation online on our Facebook or Twitter or email us at intersection@wmfe.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Aaron, let me ask you, do you get the sense that some of the folks in your audiences, these young kids who come along to hear music, that could be the seed that'll set them on a path of classical music and maybe have them conducting an orchestra sort of 20, 30 years down the track?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's always very exciting to see them in the audience and kind of gauge the reactions when I go. I try to make it a point to go out in the audience during intermission and after the concert just to talk to everybody. And another form of just trying to make everything accessible and engaging. And I think, you know, it's always a hope that you have these young minds that go out and that seed is planted. And I would have loved to sit in your little maestro circle up in Boston.
There's no age limit, Aaron.
There's no age limit. Perfect.
But it's so telling when you say you like to go out and greet people after the concert or probably before the concert or whatever. When I was in school, I was told that was forbidden. It was unprofessional for the performers to break that fourth wall, even, you know, to meet friends in the lobby or that sort of thing. If you wanted to do that, you had to change into a suit and tie and come out not in your tuxedo, in your concert attire. How ridiculous that seems now, but it was, again, that sort of pedestal idea that we represent great art and we want our audiences to look up to us and imagine us as being in some remote sphere. And for that time, I guess that was valid, but it sure isn't today.
You're absolutely right.
Christopher, I got a question, too, about the opera in Orlando. Now, that the Orlando Opera closed its doors in 2009. Was that a big blow to the artistic community?
Yeah, it was a major blow because that was a prestigious company that had thousands and thousands of subscribers and a long track record of great productions and bringing in top stars from throughout the country. And for us, they were our major collaborator. We were the orchestra in the pit for all of those programs. So we lost a collaborator, and our musicians lost a great deal of valuable work. And opera is part of the orchestral world. I mean, they're one and the same. So it was a big part of our artistic profile to lose opera. It's all synergistic, you know. It'd be the same with the ballet. We all work together, and we find ourselves on stage together. So it was a big blow, but we've been fortunate in having some very generous people and funding from United Arts and from some lead companies to step in and say, well, it's a shame that a fine organization went bankrupt, but it doesn't mean that the art form has to die in Orlando. And so we've picked it up and have done now several seasons of opera very successfully. We do it differently in terms of the staging. But the music's the same, and people seem to be loving it.
Let me ask you, too, there's quite a lot of money being spent on building new venues. We've got the Downtown Performing Arts Center, which is going up piece by piece. How much of a difference do you think it's going to make to classical music in Orlando having that theater up and running when it opens its doors?
Yeah, ultimately, it will make a huge difference, and there are three venues in there. So a Broadway house, a Black Box Theater for traditional theater, and then the jewel of the crown is that multi-form theater, the third theater, which is in phase two now, which will be a world-class venue for symphonic music, ballet, and opera. So it's a technological wonder, but now can be done and will be done, and it will sound and look fantastic for all three art forms and for many other kinds of activities. And, you know, the Bop Car has been in Orlando for such a long time, and people have gotten married in there and had their graduations in there, and generations have gotten to know symphonic music and opera and ballet and Broadway through that house. And it's still, I think, it remains a wonderful facility, a useful facility, one that all of us have been able to take good advantage of, but it certainly is not any longer, you couldn't call it state-of-the-art. And if, from an acoustical point of view, the new hall will be infinitely greater. And it will be a really exciting time for the city.
Aaron, I want to ask you, do you think the Space Coast needs something similar? Would you like to see some investment in performance halls, you know, one or perhaps more than one on the Space Coast? I mean, it's a pretty big area.
Yeah, it's the longest county in the state, and it's just, I think, it's 75 miles from end to end, and it's a lot of people live there. Yeah, absolutely. What I would really love to see, I think Brevard County, what's great about it is it has so many cultural organizations. We have one primary venue there, and that's the King Center. But it's very similar to the Bob Carr, where it's bringing in a lot of commercial productions, touring productions, and all these community groups that I think there's maybe 50 or 60 choruses, bands, orchestras that don't have access to a reasonable venue. And I think that's something that Brevard County could certainly use, and I think we're capable of bringing. Maybe not as large as the one they're doing here in Orlando, but I do think a venue where all community groups could perform, I think, would be such a benefit to all of them and something I would stand behind and would love to see.
Well, let me just ask you a final question. What are you working on at the moment, and what can audiences over the next couple of months expect to see from the Space Coast Symphony Orchestra?
Sure. We have a lot of exciting projects. Of course, we have a summer series. We're one of 19 orchestras that perform year-round, and it's very exciting. It's actually our best time. When we started the orchestra, everyone gave us kind of, the summer will never work. No one's around in the summer. But we found the absolute opposite. Like I said, we try to do everything just a bit differently, and we found that it's some of our best attended concerts are in the summer. So we have our summer series, which consists of four concerts. Then we have a chamber series as well. And our summer series usually consists of a large classical concert. This season we're doing Borden's Second Symphony. We also do a film music concert series. I'd loved film music growing up, so we pair film scores along with the films on screen, and that's become very, very successful. So we're doing Heroes of the Screen. So we have a mix of like Indiana Jones, but also like all the way to Elmer Bernstein's To Kill a Mockingbird, a different type of hero. For 2013-14 season, we're doing big projects like The Planets in partnership with NASA. We'll be performing over in NASA and the VAB, which is very exciting, and some other large orchestral works that I think audiences will really love.
And Christopher Wilkins, what can we expect from the Orlando Philharmonic?
Well, the Orlando Philharmonic has had a heck of a spring. We've had, you know, our Cirque concert, we had Midsummer Night's Dream, we had our second opera of the year, and then How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And we go plunge headlong now into our big gala of the year, still yet to come, which is at Full Sail University. It's in their new Full Sail Live venue, which is one of the state-of-the-art multimedia venues in the world. It's where the opening segment of Monday Night Football is always filmed, and they have a long collaboration now with ESPN. So we get to use that amazing room in an evening benefit. We're featuring Davis Gaines, so one of the longest-running phantoms, a phantom of the opera on Broadway, in a program we call Music of the Night. That's May 31st. After that, our next big orchestral event is toward the end of June, is Liberty Weekend. For years, we've played a free concert in the airport, in the central concourse, in the A side, the A terminal, and it's just so much fun. It's a tribute to the troops and American patriotic music, and people get off their flights from Hong Kong or from Miami, and they walk through the gate, and they think, well, what a classy city this is. They have an orchestra in their concourse. So we do that, and go into the Sounds of Summer series, as I mentioned, which is largely chamber music, a few other events here and there, and then we launch our season again in September, which I'm really looking forward to.
Do they turn the pipe music off in the Orlando International Airport when you're playing your concert?
They turn that off, and they turn the fountain off, which is fortunate, because that we play right in that where the fountain is. Surprisingly, we don't amplify it, but the sound just rings throughout that space. It's all hard surfaces and a big cavernous space, and the sound seems to go through all the restaurants, and everybody's aware that we're there on that day. That's June 29.
Well, I've been speaking to Christopher Wilkins, the music director of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra. Christopher, thank you very much for joining us.
What a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And we've also been speaking in the studio with Aaron Collins. Aaron is the conductor and artistic director of the Space Coast Symphony Orchestra. Aaron, so nice of you to join us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, a conversation with Thomas Nguyen about Vietnamese heritage in Central Florida. Just 3% of Florida's population is Asian, but US Census data shows it's fast growing. Since the 1970s, Orlando has become a hub for Florida's Vietnamese Americans, with businesses, restaurants, and until recently, a Vietnamese language radio station. I'm joined in the studio by Thomas Nguyen. He's the former host of Saigon Radio, a Vietnamese language radio station that broadcast here in Orlando, and the former president of the Vietnamese Association of Central Florida. Thomas, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
So I want to talk to you about the Vietnamese community here in Orlando. Now, it must be quite a large community if there is or was a need for a radio station broadcasting in Vietnamese.
Generally speaking, the population of Vietnamese in Central Florida maybe around 20,000. Indeed, it is necessary to have one voice. The newspapers and magazines seem to be slow and late to come to the readers, but radio always very fast that you can get in touch with the community.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of programs did you air on Saigon Radio, and how often was it broadcast?
We established since 1998. It's about 2 hours a day, every day except Sunday. In Vietnamese, in education, health, and politics, religion, everything. So it's kind of the best means that get in touch with the community, also helping to improve the relationship between the community and also other communities.
And it's not on the air currently. Why did it go off the air?
Because of the financial situation seemed to be difficult for the people to afford to pay for the expenses. We have to, let's say, budget ourselves, and it's a very tough time.
So you're planning to go back on air at some point?
Very much indeed. It's anytime soon.
Now, second-generation Vietnamese-Americans who are born here and grew up speaking English, do you feel like there's a need for them to stay connected with the Vietnamese language?
Surprisingly, let's say a lot of young people would want to know the language rather than forget about the heritage that they carry with their blood. So we do have, from time to time, there is the Vietnamese class for the students, not only Vietnamese themselves, but also some other students from other countries also attending it. They do want to have language, and they want to hear that language, the beauty of the language, connecting them together.
Do you think now that there's much more access to social media, in some ways radio is something that maybe people don't need so much anymore to stay connected with that culture?
Yeah, we try to diversify in means of mass media to social media. So mass media is the radio, you know, so we try to get into maybe TV in the future. And also social media is that's Facebook and Twitter and everything you can name it. Even meetings here and there and conference and festivals, Buddhist temples and churches, big numbers of people attending every week. And then they have classes over there for the languages and cultures. And this is a lot of things that's offered for people to come together. In Florida, we carry about maybe about 70,000 Asian community. We just had at the Avalon Park Festival's celebration of Asian community, drawing maybe about 3,000 or 4,000 people in there. Mm-hmm. A lot of vendors, and we have cultural shows for every country, like Korean, Japanese, Vietnamese, Indonesian, Malaysian, Filipinos, and Chinese, everyone.
So it's a pretty diverse spread of Asian Americans living in Central Florida. Is the Vietnamese community the biggest kind of segment of that community?
It's more active. And it's more permanent because of business around, like a colonial and mills and somewhere around. So it's very big numbers of the community businesses, nail salon and hair salon, doctor office, attorneys and real estate.
What do you think the impact has been of communities like the Vietnamese, the Chinese, the Korean communities in Central Florida?
Let's say historically, the Vietnamese and Chinese cannot get along well for so many thousand years in the past. But it's the people living in this area, Central Florida, seem to be like living together as human being. Mm-hmm. And it's a brotherhood rather than anything else. The difference is politically. You can call this a melting pot.
I've been speaking to Thomas Nguyen, the former host of Saigon Radio, a Vietnamese language radio station that broadcast out of Orlando. He's also the former president of the Vietnamese Association of Central Florida. Thomas, thank you very much for coming in and speaking to me.
Thank you for having me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.